Choose a Vibe community, we actually need your help. Every week, we ask you guys to leave reviews for this podcast, and the follow-through has been mind-blowing. We've received over 3,000 five-star reviews, and it's just incredible. Honestly, I read every single one of these. Everyone on our team does as well, so thank you. And I have another ask for you. If you've purchased one of our books, if you've read one of our books through the library, we need you to leave a review. This makes an enormous difference. We are really, really trying to grow Choose It by Publishing, and this will be a game changer for us. So if you've already purchased one of the books, we'd love it if you could leave a review at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, or wherever you purchase it from. And if you haven't bought one of our books and want to check out the lineup, head to choosefi.com/publishing, and you can see all of the titles available. We would really love it if you could purchase one and leave a review. It would really mean the world to us. So thank you, as always.
All right, guys, kicking off our FI household today, we're getting the opportunity to explore Zach and Marilyn's story with this particular one. We aired their voicemail several weeks ago when we did. We were introducing the households of FI, but to catch you up and give you the highlight reel, we're doing a longitudinal study. This is a word that I had to practice ahead of time with Brad was coaching me through it. I feel like Brad, did I nail it? Nailed it.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Zach and Marilyn, they're married, two kids. They're new to the idea of financial independence, and they feel like their strength or one of the things they want to focus on is real estate, that this could be an option for them. So we asked them just some questions to kind of get a sense for challenges. And they say at this point they are out of debt and they actually use the Dave Ramsey baby steps, but they have this kind of now what sensation. I know many of us who have benefited from Ramsey's content kind of had that moment like, huh, all right, you know, I got to the end of baby step three and I know there's more, but they're kind of a little bit lackluster. Like maybe there's more. What else is there? Financial independence. Yes, here it is. Now, they want to be able to put together a roadmap with an emphasis on financial independence as the goal. They had a couple questions about what accounts money should go into and what accounts that they would be drawing from. Their really big interest was, all right, you know, we're going from thinking we might be interested in real estate to actually taking action. Ideas, dime a dozen, action, everything. We need some accountability and we could use some insight to get started here to avoid the pitfalls and then kind of use this pathway to increase their savings rate with a focus on increasing their income. So they asked for us to connect them with someone in the financial industry space that could really coach them through this. We obviously immediately thought of Paula Pant and we were able to set up that intro and we have this phenomenal, wow, it's so good. This phenomenal segment teed up for you. And with that, welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is your Friday Roundup.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys. Well, I'm really excited about this. We were able to connect Zach and Marilyn with Paula Pant from Afford Anything. And Brad, she was unbelievably generous with her time.
Yeah, Paula is incredible. She's a good friend of ours, a good friend of our shows. And Zach and Marilyn, as you're going to hear, they got a lot out of this. So yeah, huge thank you to Paula. And for any of you that don't know, Paula has a podcast, Afford Anything. And certainly you can find her at affordanything.com.
I would also say, I just want to throw this in there. Paula, to this day, has one of my favorite free ebooks for her email subscribers. And it is written with the humor that she always brings. You know, it's just a fun read. And so for our audience that'd be interested in that, go check out affordanything.com/escape. It's just a free giveaway for her email subscribers. Blow up her email inbox. I think she'll get a huge kick out of that. So anyways, back to the show.
Hi, Zach and Marilyn.
Hi, Paula.
Hi, Paula.
What part of the country are you in right now?
We are in southern Utah.
And that explains the paintings behind you.
Yes, a little red rock going on back there.
Yeah.
Nice. If you don't mind me asking, how old are both of you?
Yeah. So I'm 34.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't know.
I'm 32.
She's 32. She yes. turned 32 in March. Yep. I have to keep track, though.
I can't ever
She'll
remember.
She'll never remember. I'm lost without this one. Yes.
Awesome. So tell me about yourselves.
Okay, so we got a young family. We really enjoy the outdoors. I actually got my undergraduate degree in outdoor recreation, and Southern Utah is a really great place for recreation, so we have a lot of fun getting out, hiking around, being outdoorsy kind of people. I recently finished a master's degree in social work, so I'm a brand new therapist, just working on getting licensed as a therapist. And yeah, we've always not really made a ton of money. Yeah. We've always lived like... For several years, we were actually below the poverty line.
Yeah.
But
and during that time, we got out of debt.
We did.
When we lived below the poverty line. Yeah.
That's amazing. Congratulations. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
So
I want the ability to like put like balloons and streamers on this video right now.
We'll have confetti in the background.
There's confetti going off in my head if that helps.
Perfect.
Yeah. So we got married young. We were still in school. The school debt, buying a car,
medical debt, credit cards. I mean, it was a mess.
It was a hot mess. Yeah. But we got out of debt and we've been debt free for about two years
now. Yeah.
And throughout that time, we've had some experience with purchasing and selling properties. And so that kind of leads us to where we are now, where we're debt free and we're trying to like plan for the future and like maximize all of our ideas and resources and all that stuff.
And to add to our financial story a little bit, Marilyn went back to work about a year ago. So that's added, like almost doubled our income. So that was pretty amazing. But yeah, as Marilyn mentioned, moving into houses, as I've kind of studied the market a little bit, I believe the term is live in flip.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we'll buy places that, you know, probably most people wouldn't want to buy.
Yeah.
And as we live in them, like our very first condo that we bought for $65,000, the day we closed on it, we had told ourselves, we're not going to touch it for a year. We'll just live in it like it is.
And
for
we
a
lied.
Year. And the day we closed on it, we were pulling up carpet, you know, we were looking at paint samples Yeah, so we were able to sell that for a pretty good profit, and every property it's kind of been like that.
Yep.
Nice. Yeah. How long do you typically live in a home before you move out and flip it?
We've always told ourselves we were going to stay in places for long periods of time, and we never stay more than a year.
So our first condo that we bought, we owned it for longer than we lived in it.
Yeah, so we moved out and we rented that place for another year after we'd moved out.
And then we moved again away from Cedar and we sold that so that we could buy another home that we were looking at. And then we did some good work there and then sold it and moved back to Cedar.
So Cedar City is where we live currently.
Oh, yeah,
Cedar City, Utah. But yeah, I guess there's a rule where you can't have an FHA loan if you have like outstanding balances on another FHA loan. Mm-hmm. So we had to sell our rental, which was only cash flowing like $100 a month.
Great.
So honestly, it was almost more trouble than it was worth. So we sold that place to get into another house, which we then flipped, and we just kept the cash when that one was done with. But yeah, we made a $50,000 profit on that one. So that was pretty sweet.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. As you move the money, do you use a 1031 exchange in order to move it?
Yes, we've always put it into the next house.
Yeah. Nice.
So as much as we'd like to just have $50,000 in the bank, we've always just put that in. So the house we're in now is actually the first house that we haven't had to pay mortgage insurance because we were able to put that $50,000 down on the house.
That's awesome. Congrats.
A cool feeling for sure. So yeah.
That's super cool. So what questions do you have today? I know that you've come to talk about real estate, but I need to know more.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've listened to your podcast a whole ton. Yeah. So.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No.
That's great.
It's been amazing. I a little bit know your philosophies, but I guess probably the biggest question that I have is on the 1% rule. So generally speaking, you know, you want to be able to rent the place for 1% of what you've bought it for. Is there any circumstances right now we're in kind of a market that's a little bit inflated?
Yeah.
And is there any circumstances where you wouldn't follow the 1% rule?
Yes, absolutely. So I love this question. So the 1% rule, as you just explained, is this rule of thumb that a property should rent for, the monthly rent should be 1% of the total purchase price. So for every $100,000 worth of house, it should rent for at least $1,000 a month. $200,000 home, $2,000 a month. Now, the reason, before I go into, and the answer to your question is yes, like there are definitely exceptions to the rule. But in order to go into that, let me explain the why behind the 1% rule. And the reasoning behind it is, if we're just painting with an extremely broad paintbrush, if a property rents for 1% of its purchase price per month, that's 12% per year at full occupancy. And there's another rule of thumb in the world of real estate called the 50% rule of thumb, which is a broad, rough estimate that your operating expenses like repairs, maintenance, major capital expenditures, property taxes, homeowners insurance, that all of those operating costs will be about 50% of the rent. And so if a property rents for 12% of its purchase price every year and half of that goes to operating costs, then the other half of that, 6%, is what's left over. And that 6% essentially is the unleveraged dividend on that property. So in order to get to, let's assume that a property keeps pace with inflation, but no more. So let's just, we're not going to assume any kind of property rising in value. We're just going to keep pace with inflation, which is 3% per year, roughly, historically. So if a property gives you a 6% dividend plus that 3% inflationary increase, it's a total return of 9%. So that's the reason why the 1% rule of thumb exists. It's not meant to be make or break criteria. It exists purely because when you start looking for properties, you go on Zillow, Redfin, or Trulia, or any of those websites, and you're going to be looking at hundreds, maybe thousands of potential homes. And you just need a quick and dirty, like, way to swipe left or swipe right. You know, like, you just need some type of filtering criteria. And so the 1% rule of thumb is this crude, blunt instrument that, like, when you're looking at 1,000 properties and you just need a way of filtering them down, it's that crude, blunt instrument for doing that initial filtering. But the reason that I explained the why behind it is that, as you can see, if you want to ultimately, like, the goal in the example that I just gave, the goal is to achieve a 9% total return or a 6%-ish cap rate, right? If ultimately that's the goal, if that's the why behind the 1% rule, well, there are multiple ways to do that. So there might be a specific property where the operating expenses on that property are going to be lower than the norm. They're going to be less than that 50% rule, maybe because it's in a location that has cheap property taxes. Maybe it's new construction or recently renovated, and so the repairs, maintenance, capex are going to be pretty low. There are a number of reasons why the operating expenses might not be 50%. They might not consume 50% of their rent. They might consume 40% or 30%. And if that's the case, then heck, you get those same returns without a property having to meet the 1% rule. The other exception that I make to it is anytime that you're house hacking. And so house hacking for, I know you guys know what it is, but for everybody out there in video land who's watching this, who is not familiar with that term, house hacking is the practice where you buy a home. And I guess, I don't know if a live and flip would be considered a house hack. Typically in the context of rentals, it's usually used to refer to buying a multi-unit residence, like a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex, living in one of the units and then renting out the others. Or if you did it with a single family home, it would be buying a single family home, living in one of the bedrooms, renting out the other bedrooms to roommates, or living in the in-law suite, buying a home with an in-law suite or a mother-in-law house and living in one of the structures and renting out the other structure. So anyway, so that's a house hack. And if you're house hacking, you're not purely buying an investment, because you have to buy a property that you would be comfortable living in for at least a year, you know, which means it needs to be reasonably close to work. It might be a horrible commute, but it needs to at least be a reasonable, horrible commute. The property that you're choosing is curtailed by these personal factors that are not investment related. It's got to be a decent commute to work. If you have kids who go to public school, it's got to be in a decent public school district. You know, you're making the selection based not just on investment criteria, but also personal criteria. And so for that reason, I say throw the 1% rule out the window, or at least relax it significantly when you're house hacking, because you're not looking just for an investment. You're looking for a home that lives in that Venn diagram intersection of investment and personal.
And a house hack is what we're looking to get into. I am looking at right now, we have a twin home here in Cedar City that's on the market right now for like $240,000.
For both sides.
Right. So you get both sides, and we could rent one side of it for like $1,200 to $1,500, mm-hmm. which would pretty much pay the mortgage on the other side.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
And there's other places like, so right now we live in a twin home and the other side of it is for sale for $198,000. And I'm thinking, well, that doesn't follow the 1% rule, but it'd be nice to have that. We could at least cash flow $400 or $500, which would go towards our mortgage.
Well, and the one that you mentioned, $240,000 for both units, and then one of the units rents for between $1,200 to $1,500 per month, that totally meets the 1% rule.
Yeah,
in fact, it
absolutely
beats it, you know, because that's the other, just for everyone who's watching this on video, in a situation like that where you've got, as I'm sure you already know, where you've got two units, you do the math on the 1% rule as though you were paying rent to yourself, you know?
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
If each side rents for $1,200 a month, then the two combined rent for $2,400 a month.
Right.
And the property costs $240,000. That's perfect.
Yeah.
I started investing in Fundrise in January of 2017, actually. And it was incredibly easy to get set up. I just created an account and I bought $1,000 of their Heartland E-REIT. And it couldn't have been easier. I just set up a link to my bank account and purchased $1,000 of that e-read. And it really, truly was as simple as that. It was one of the most intuitive and easiest investing platforms that I've ever seen. Fundrise's team of real estate professionals carefully vets and actively manages all of their real estate projects. And with their easy-to-use website, you can track your portfolio's performance and watch as properties across the country are acquired, improved, and operated via asset updates. Start building your better portfolio today. Get started at fundrise.com/choosefi to have your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. That's fundrise.com/choosefi to have your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. fundrise.com/choosefi. Reaching financial independence is a long-term goal. And for a lot of people, it's difficult to have a sense of where they are. New Retirement is a financial planning software that understands the FI community. They don't assume you'll have the same income or job every year. They understand you want a way to manage a budget and plan for passive income streams. They want you to experiment with Roth conversions and withdrawal strategies to reach your goals faster. That's why we recommend newretirement.com to create a plan for FI. Get started today for free. It takes less than 5 minutes to create a new retirement plan. You'll get a plan score and receive personalized suggestions to help you improve. And you'll have access to tax insights to make informed decisions. Take control of your future and build your plan for financial independence today. Visit newretirement.com/choosefi and get 14 days for free. You may even find ideas to save thousands of dollars or learn that you will reach FI sooner than you think. Go to newretirement.com/choosefi to learn more.
So, like I said, we're in a little bit of an inflated market right now, and that's a little frustrating to live somewhere where the properties aren't necessarily worth as much as they're selling for, but people are buying them. We've got a lot of folks from California who come in, and, you know, to them, it's like, oh, this is a steal, because in California, that house is $500,000.
Yeah.
So one thing we're looking at is some markets where the numbers make a little bit better sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would you ever invest in a market where you don't live there? And I don't know, it seems
and
like it would be difficult.
How do you navigate that?
It'd be difficult to manage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. So I actually, when I started buying rental properties, I bought locally. At the time, I lived in Atlanta, and so I also bought in Atlanta. And then after a while, after a couple of years, I moved to Las Vegas, Nevada. And so I had that experience of living 2,000 miles away from all of my rental properties.
Yeah.
And frankly, I love it. Like, being an out-of-state landlord is way better. Because the thing is...
So good.
When you're... Or I'll speak for myself. When I was in town, I didn't have to build a system or build a business. Like, I didn't have to treat it like a business because it was so easy to just... go over there and myself and replace the batteries in the smoke alarm.
Or mow the lawn or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just so easy to go there myself to do all these like little tasks and tweaks and things that I never had to build processes, build systems, treat it like a business, because it was just so easy to just to skirt that. And once I moved to Las Vegas, then I was forced to actually build processes. So I just gave the example of putting, like checking on the batteries in the smoke detector, right? So I have a checklist of things that I do at every, or things that my property managers or like a representative of mine, a member of my team does at every move in and move out. Like I've got a checklist for every turnover, but I didn't start building that until I came to Las Vegas. The reason that I gave the smoke alarm example is because in our lease, we state that, you know, it's the tenant's responsibility to check the batteries in the smoke alarm and replace when necessary. But if a tenant is moving into a unit for the first time, it's the landlord's responsibility to make sure that the batteries are working on the day of move-in, right? I didn't have a line item about that in my move-in, move-out checklist. Like, it was just such a small thing. I overlooked it. I forgot it. And so on one of my properties, it was move-in day. The tenant moved in. The smoke alarm was chirping, which is that sound that it makes, the really annoying sound that it makes to indicate the batteries are low. And I had to call a contractor who then charged a $75 like site visit fee just to change a set of batteries.
Yes.
So some people might hear that and think, oh, that's a reason not to invest out of state. You've got to pay $75 for someone to replace batteries. But really, you only have to do that once before you learn your lesson and put it in the checklist. And then you have a process that makes sure that that's never going to happen again.
So instead, you're just paying your property manager that you have a fee to go do all of these things, and it's not costing you so much. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've got a property manager, and then I also have my own checklists and processes, and that helps me manage the manager.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Oh, that's good. Manage the manager. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have lots of questions, but I guess my biggest thing is, if you're looking for properties, do you look for deals, or do you have like a criteria that you look for? Because like I can walk into a house and be like, oh, I love this. We'll change this.
Start
we'll do this. We'll
design.
Do that. It'll be great. We can like finish this out, and it'll be, you know, I can do that in any house that I walk into. So I get caught up in like, okay, but is this like a good house to purchase? Like, do you look for fixer-uppers? Do you look for homes that are more move-in ready? Like, what's your preference, I guess?
Well, let me ask you, what level of time and interest do you have in managing a fixer-upper?
I guess it depends a little bit if it's one we're going to live in again. If we're going to live in it, the design matters, you know?
Yeah.
But if we're not going to live in it, I care about that a lot less.
Yeah. So if we live in it, we have no problem doing a fixer-upper. I mean, it could be a hole in the ground and we could figure something out. But yeah, so I think it just depends on the situation, whether we're buying it strictly for rentals or if we're going to live in it. So yeah. And we both work, so we don't have a ton of time.
Not these days.
At least right now we don't.
Right. So one thing that I teach the students in my course, I teach this course on rental property investing. And towards the beginning of the course, I have this chart. You're just going to have to like visualize this in your head. So imagine on the x-axis, so on that horizontal line, imagine that it's a spectrum. And on one side of the spectrum, you find deals. And on the other side, you create deals, right? So finding a deal would be like logging onto the MLS, you know, or going on Zillow or Trulia or Redfin and just seeing something that's publicly listed for sale. Like that's all the way on the finding end of the spectrum. And then over on the creating a deal end of the spectrum, you would have like postcard campaigns or direct mail campaigns or working with wholesalers, some of those more like creative off-market ways of looking for deals, right? So that's, imagine that as the x-axis. And then the y-axis, imagine in terms of what you just asked about renovations, imagine that on one end of the spectrum, you have great condition, move-in ready, looks beautiful. And then at the other end of the spectrum, it's not even habitable. Like, it would not even merit a certificate of occupancy from the county. And then, you know, you've got every kind of everything in between. You've got like the paint and carpet remodel, you know, and then you've got the, so you've got kind of a cosmetic remodel, or you could have like more of a mechanical remodel, or, you know, changes to the foundation, all the different degrees of damage that could be repaired, the different degrees to which a thing could be a fixer-upper. And so if you imagine sort of that trade-off between effort and reward, as you dial yourself along these two spectrums, the effort increases, but often the reward also increases. So if you think all the way into one quadrant where you're finding off-market deals through direct mail postcard campaigns, and then you're buying them and they're total fixer-uppers, and so then you're also fixing them up, you're like all the way into the hardest quadrant of that graph, that's where the effort is going to be the highest, but that's also typically where the profits are the highest. But on the other hand, if you want, if you're working full time and you've got a family and you want to at some point in your life go to the gym, you know, like bucket list.
Yes.
You know, then it's totally okay to be in that easier quadrant where you're buying something off of the MLS that's move-in ready. And then, of course, there's sort of all of those quadrants and points along the spectrum in between where maybe you don't want to mess around with direct mail campaigns or creative searches. Like, you just want to buy a publicly listed property, but you're cool with it being a fixer-upper. Or maybe vice versa. Maybe you want it to be move-in ready, but you're cool putting more effort into the search. Mm-hmm. All of those would be examples kind of around the middle end of that spectrum. So it's very much, I think, there's no right or wrong way to do it. It's largely going to be a personal question about trade-offs. Is it worth your time, your energy, the opportunity cost of other money that you could be making? Is it worth that to get a fixer-upper or to look for off-market deals? Or is it more worth your time to say, you know what, I'm cool with getting a lower profit if it means that it's going to have a lower pain in the butt factor?
Right. It's true.
We want a low pain in the butt factor.
Okay, so my next question is kind of in relation to the amount of money that we make. We don't make a whole lot of money, but we're debt-free, you know, and so we have a mortgage. And so when I think of purchasing other properties, instead of seeing it like as an investment, I think, oh, we have that much more debt because we had to like work so hard to get to zero. And so how do you view mortgages and things like that? Because it gives me a panic attack, I think, sometimes.
So I think of mortgages very differently if it's an investment property, like a rental property, versus if it's a personal residence. Okay. Honestly, if it's a personal residence and it just purely a personal property, I think of that mortgage as debt. Yeah. Because a personal residence is something that you're buying for the sake of your own consumption. It's ultimately taking money out of your wallet every month. But with an investment property, a cash flow positive investment property, then that debt is a tool that allows you to access something that is ultimately cash flow positive. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to say that I don't see that as debt, because it is debt and it is leverage, and leverage is like a lever. It can ping you up or throw you down. But I guess the distinction that I make is cash flow negative versus cash flow positive. If it's a personal property, a personal purchase, it's cash flow negative. If it's a rental property and you're doing it right, it's cash flow positive.
Yeah. So kind of along those lines, like for you personally, is there a price range you don't ever exceed as far as like the amount that a property is worth?
No, but there is a balance of equity to debt that I try not to exceed.
Okay.
So for me, across all of my properties, it doesn't matter how it divides out into house A versus house B versus house C, but the aggregate across the entire portfolio, I personally like to keep it at 50-50 at the most. So for every dollar in equity that I have, a dollar in debt at the most. And if I end up paying down even more debt and having 75-25 and 75% equity to 25% debt, that's fine. But for me personally, I don't like it to go more than 50-50. Now, most real estate investors are going to say that that's very conservative. A lot of real estate investors are 80-20 or 90-10 or 99-1, you know? But like, I know myself, I'm like you. I grew up in a family that really was very anti-debt, very anti-debt. Yeah. So I know myself well enough that mm-hmm. for being able to sleep at night, I like to keep the equity to debt at 50-50.
Okay. So kind of along the same lines, since we're talking about like money, do you have a certain amount of cash on hand for
the water heater goes out?
Yeah. Or like, you know, it's not rented for a month and you need to pay the mortgage. Like, how do you kind of calculate that so that you can make sure that you are not scrambling, you know, if something goes wrong?
Yeah. So what I tell people, all right, actually, I'll ask this back at you. What's the standard thing that people say when it comes to personal emergency fund? What's the standard number of months?
So first, 6 months.
3 to 6 months is like the standard cliche personal finance advice.
Yeah.
The way to do that with a rental property is between 3 to 6 months of gross rent. What I usually tell people is start when you're starting, like when you first buy the property, on the day that you sign that contract, on the day you close on that property, have 3 months of gross rent set aside and just make that your bare minimum cash reserves. And then as time goes on and you have the ability to grow that bucket to 6 months, great, but make 3 months the minimum.
That's good to know. Okay, so then I guess another question is, we chatted about this last night. So we don't make a lot of money combined together. We have lots of access to retirement accounts that we put money into to kind of grow those accounts.
That's a good question.
But we could not put that much money into the accounts to kind of build up our cash on hand so we would be able to be in a better position to buy a property.
Have a bigger down payment.
Yeah, or have the 3 months, you know, on hand when we sign. I mean, I think this is something we're going to pursue.
This is something we're definitely going to do.
Whether or not, you know, whatever situation we're in. So would you recommend not putting as much money into those accounts so we can get to that place faster? And then, you know, as things kind of grow, we can
go back
to it or I don't know.
Yeah.
So what I would recommend doing is take a step back, like zoom out and look at in terms of your budget as a whole. What percentage of your savings do you want to put into real estate and what percentage of your savings do you want to put into retirement accounts? So just as an example, like for a person or for a couple that might be saving 20% of their income, maybe they want to divide that half and half. So 10% goes to retirement accounts, 10% to real estate. And that's just a hypothetical example, but I would reframe the question not as should we be putting less into retirement? I would reframe it as what's our overall budget? How much from our overall budget do we want to save? And then how do we want to slice up that savings pie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a good way to
it's
put
it. A good
it.
Way to look at it. Cause I mean, real estate is also an investment.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Instead of looking at it as like, oh, we're just going to spend this money or whatever. Yeah. Like we're investing it in just another bucket.
So, right now, like Zach was saying, you know, our market is really inflated. And I think maybe for like comfort's sake, it's like, okay, if we're going to do this, it might be a little bit nicer to buy kind of locally. But where our prices are really inflated, like during this time, you know, pandemic and all these things and government stimuluses, do we wait and just kind of watch things or like, we're not going to have another 2008 again, you know, where everything is dirt cheap. At least I don't think that's going to happen. But like, do we wait and kind of just watch things or like, I don't know.
We could be waiting forever.
Yeah.
You know? So eventually we've got to make a decision.
Yeah. We don't want like analysis paralysis where we're like, well, it's not checking all the boxes. And so we're not going to do it yet. So
first of all, that's the first time I've ever heard someone say we're not going to have another 2008 again and mean it in a positive and frame 2008 in a positive light.
Yeah.
Darn the good old days.
Take it. Oh gosh, sorry if I offend anybody.
I'm not going to have another 1929 again. So what I often tell people, and I say this to people also who ask a similar question about buying stocks or buying index funds, If you think about Warren Buffett or any of the major investors, Benjamin Graham, Philip Fisher, any of the like famous investors, they didn't make their money by looking at prices and trying to judge those prices relative to where they were or where they might be in the future. They simply looked at prices and said, is this a good deal right now in the present moment? Regardless of where it was in the past, regardless of where it may or may not go in the future, these numbers today, does it make sense? Yes or no? And if the numbers today make sense, then they buy. And similarly, you know, when they look at their holdings, when they get to the point where they're holding something and the numbers on it, you know, the market shifts enough that the numbers no longer make sense, then they sell. And if you just repeatedly do that throughout your life over and over, you ultimately win. Like you ultimately come out ahead. So don't get caught up in market timing. Instead, just focus on, it's like the Zen of investing, like be here now, you know, like where are we in the present? Yeah, exactly.
Okay. That's good. That's good thoughts.
Well, we got a lot of notes and we got a lot to think about.
Yeah.
The decisions to make.
Do we have any other questions? Did you have any other questions?
I think you covered them. You took good notes.
Do you have any other
advice
for us as we do this? Or?
Well, you seem to be doing the live and flip thing really well. What I always tell people who are doing like live and flips or any type of live and rehab is, and I'm sure you guys have already mastered this since you've already done it, but it can sometimes be so hard to separate what you personally want from what just makes sense as a good investment. Mm-hmm. So like the very first kitchen that I remodeled was in a unit that I was living in. And, you know, when I remodel other kitchens and other rental properties, if I'm putting in granite countertops, for example, I might do granite tile instead of granite slab because granite tile is a heck of a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
Right. And I'll just do the basic builder grade, like Baltic Brown or mm-hmm. Santa Cecilia, like those basic builder grade types of granites.
Yeah.
But when I lived there, I got the slab and I got the fancy slab.
You know? Treat yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And, and then I got like a beveled edge.
Yeah. All the details.
Exactly. Like I spent way too much on those countertops, more than is justified for investment purposes. So just as you're doing, especially when you're living there, like be wary of that. Like be aware of times when emotionally you might be tempted to spend a little more than is necessary from the perspective of someone who's doing a detached remodel.
Okay, I think that's pretty good advice.
That's really good. Awesome.
We've got some good homework to do. Thanks so much for all the information.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking this time to chat.
Yes. Thanks, Paula.
Yeah, and congrats on everything you've done so far.
Thank you. Appreciate it. There's still a ways to go.
Yes. I think we're on the right path, so it's great.
Awesome. All right. Bye.
Okay. See ya.
Wow. So, 30 minutes, but so much was covered in this episode, Brad. And as I was riffing through it and I was looking at my notes, and my notes were kind of scarce, but your notes were very comprehensive, which was awesome. But there is like, I think that what this episode was, it was like a springboard for a better question. And the first observation that we had is they've actually have done a few live-in flips, and they've been using something called the 1031 exchange, which I have heard about in the real estate space before, but I don't think we have an episode dedicated to the 1031 exchange. And let me just spoiler surprise for audience. This won't be that episode either. But I noticed it made your notes as well. Have you heard of this before?
Yeah, I've definitely heard of it. And yeah, this was an open question that I had, which is kind of one of the great parts about this podcast, right? It's like, we're all learning together. And my initial question was, regarding the capital gains tax. So I just quickly looked up 1031 exchange to get a definition. I'll read it here. So it allows you to avoid paying capital gain taxes when you sell an investment property and reinvest the proceeds from the sale within certain time limits in a property or properties of like kind and equal or greater value. So the kind of layman's terms here is that you have an investment property, you're selling it. Right now, in normal terms, if there is a gain on that, you would pay capital gains tax on that. So what happens is this enables you to purchase a property within a specific amount of time. I always thought it was 45 days. I need to look that up and confirm. But if you can buy, again, according to those rules, right? So it's like kind and equal or greater value, then you can defer that tax hit. So it just gets rolled into this next property in essence. And that is something we'll have to get an expert on. And we can talk about that very specifically, how people would take advantage of it, what the pitfalls are, because it is very precise. If you miss by a day, no soup for you, basically.
Dude, I watched that episode like 3 days ago.
Nice.
As soon as I burn through my like Netflix queue, it's back to Seinfeld.
Yeah, I realize how dated that makes me at this point, a Seinfeld reference. But
like the world can be categorized, two categories. It's binary. People that get that reference and people that don't.
Oh, man. But, you know, it's funny. My first thought when listening to the episode was, so they're doing live-in flips. So that suggests to me that this is a primary residence that they're living in. Mm. And my first thought was when they specifically said they haven't lived in them for more than 1 year, I know there are the rules with your primary residence that enables you to get a capital gains exclusion if you've lived in the house for two years, but they specifically say it's two of the previous 5 years. But for the sake of what we're talking about, if you lived in your primary residence for two straight years, the capital gains exclusion is $250,000 of gain if you're single, or $500,000 if you file a joint return with your spouse, which is in the case here of Zach and Marilyn. So in those 2 years, that house can go up $500,000 and you would still pay $0 in capital gains tax when you sell it. Now that's if it's your primary residence. And again, it's two of the previous 5 years, but in this case, we're talking about two straight years. So there's some interplay here, Jonathan, that we're unaware of. And we'll have to ask Paula about. She naturally said, oh, did you 1031 it? But in the definition of 1031, it is for investment properties. So I think that's something we need a little further detail about for sure.
Right. So kind of you have two mechanisms. There's the investment property and then the primary residence property. So primary residence, the rule you just described, the capital gains exclusion, that's your amazing, generous tax code working for you there if your house appreciates.
And that is a permanent, sorry to talk over you because you're going to keep going with that, but that is a permanent exclusion on that tax. It's not rolling forward. It is just you sell it. It's under those limits. Permanent. You will never pay tax on that. It doesn't get built into your next house.
It's so easy. You just have to find a house that will appreciate by $500,000 over the next 5 years. Done. Like anybody could do this. Come on, man.
Or less.
But then too, like, well, what if this is my second property? This is my rental property, which is the situation that Paula finds herself in as an out-of-state landlord. The game here, I think, is that usually landlords are like rolling their home, their unit, which is, you know, the technical term, or their door, depending on how they call it, into a bigger unit, right? So maybe you're trying to get a single family home, you roll that into a duplex, duplex into a triplex, triplex into a quad or a commercial prop, whatever. And you're just able to roll the value over to avoid the tax hit because, again, you weren't eligible for the capital gains exclusion that you would have been if it were at your primary residence. So there's a huge strategy there that I know people take advantage of. I think there's going to be an episode called 1031 Exchange where we break it down. All right. Next, I think it's just, you know, kind of definitions of terms here. They mentioned it and Paul did a fantastic job, but just for our audience, you know, I think repetition is good here. 1% rule for aspiring real estate investors, just the rules of thumb. That way, when you are, you know, scoping on Zillow, and you're thinking about your first property, like how can you just quickly write things off and kind of what sort of metrics could you use to say, ooh, there's opportunity everywhere. And if not in my zip code, maybe in the country.
Yeah. And Paula used a great phrase. It is a crude, blunt instrument. How fantastic is that, right? Crude, blunt instrument to just initially filter. And I think that's a great way. When we're talking about all of these rules of thumb that we talk about on the podcast, the 4% rule of thumb in terms of safe withdrawal rates, right, which is outside of the scope of what we're talking about here. But in the case of these rental properties, this 1% rule of thumb, it helps you initially filter. And Paula gave additional nuance, certainly. But in essence, what you're doing is you're looking at the purchase price and you're saying, what is 1% of that? Right. So just simple math, you know, multiply by 0.01, or just say, hey, if it's a $100,000 house, does this rent for $1,000 per month or more? If so, that hits the 1% rule of thumb here. So it's just, is your monthly rent 1% of the purchase price? That's this crude blunt instrument in this case.
What's funny about this, Brad, is Paula just like called me out in this episode. And I have kind of, it's been one of those things, man, I think I'd kind of like to do real estate. I'd like to dabble. I'd like to build my talent stack. I'd like to get some experience with this other form of investment, real estate investing. And then what always has kind of slowed down is, man, I don't know, Richmond, I feel like other people find great deals, but I don't feel like Richmond, you know, if you're not down in the weeds looking for the great deals, is like a great deal location. Then I get hung up and I'm like, all right, well, if there's not great deals here, I'm just gonna, I'll just wait. I'll just do something else. But Paula in the episode says, I love being an out-of-state landlord. I love it. I'm like, oh yeah, maybe I could love it too if I would just lean in and do this. And I you know, I'm going somewhere with this with people. I want to say that, Brad, you took action on this. You didn't have the same hang up that I did. You are an out-of-state landlord. How's that experience been?
Yeah, it's been good so far. I mean, I've been a landlord, I guess, now for a year and change, probably a year and a half almost on the first property. So I wound up buying two fairly low-cost properties in Georgia. And I think I may have mentioned this on the podcast. I'm not 100% sure though, but yeah, after some repairs, I guess on each of them, when I purchased them there, the total cost of each property was about $50,000 to $55,000. And I agree with Paula. I genuinely love being an out-of-state landlord because for the exact same reasons, like she said, when she's in town, it was so easy to just do them herself, right? And not treat it like a business. Whereas I want nothing to do with these properties, frankly. Like, I want to treat it solely like a business. Does this make sense today? Which was another thing she said at the end. Is this a business today? Is this cash flow positive? Is this getting the return that I want? That's how you look at it. And embedded in that, obviously, there are property management fees. There are other things that go into, hey, I need to build a process to make this work without me getting in there and fixing a toilet or repairing a roof that's, you know, I mean, I'm not going to do these things. But when you think of it like a business, it either works or it doesn't work, right?
Well, if it works or doesn't work, let's look at kind of loosely your rough numbers. I know I didn't prep you ahead of time. You didn't know I was going to do this, but just generally, you said they were low cost properties and you said you picked them up for around $55,000 per property. Yeah. That's close. And did that, when you say $55,000, did that include after repairs or?
Yes. That was purchase price plus repairs for sure.
Cool. So then we have this 1% rule, which says if you spend $55,000 on a property, you would need to get at least 500 and fit. Like, I guess that's my question too. Does the 1% rule include the purchase price plus repairs?
Yeah. In my mind's eye, definitely. I kind of bake that in as the purchase price. Okay. So in order to get this habitable, basically, it needed to include these repairs. So I just included these repairs. So yeah, in my mind's eye, the purchase price was actual purchase price plus repairs.
So then $550 a month would be kind of the threshold for rent you would hope you get. And how has that turned out? Were you getting 550?
Yeah. I mean, so far so good. The market price was actually closer to $750 or $800, which is amazing. So yeah, it's been like almost 1.4% rule, which has really been pretty remarkable.
All right. Well, now let's flesh that out because you're doing it remote. So you couldn't just account for like you're treating it like a business. Brad is not there changing light bulbs, handling vacancies. Have you had any vacancies since you got the properties?
So I have not had any vacancies since they have been ready to rent. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now that obviously I said there were repairs. So from the purchase date until they were ready to rent, that was a couple of months, certainly in the case of each of the properties. So yes, they unquestionably were empty, completely vacant for a couple of months each. But since the initial renter, I have had an unbroken streak here, which, you know, kind of knock on wood.
Sorry, no, I didn't mean to draw attention to it. I'm sure you'll be fine.
No. but I mean, that's part of this, right? And that ties into what Paula said about having an emergency fund. And also, again, thinking of this as a business. Like, I know that I have been fortunate so far. So the other rule of thumb is the 50% rule of thumb, right? Ooh. Which is roughly 50% of your gross rent will go towards expenses of various kinds. So now, clearly baked into there is property management. It's things that people might not even think of if they weren't thinking like a business, right? So it's the homeowner's insurance. That's being paid by me. So clearly that's in there. The property taxes, clearly being paid, that's in there. Then obviously if anything breaks, et cetera, kind of generally speaking, you kind of reserve mentally for, hey, the air conditioner is going to break or need replacing every 10 years, right? So you have to factor that in. There's going to be some repairs, some capital improvements. Like these things you have to realize. Life is lumpy, which is a quote we've used here on Choose a Viola, which I just absolutely love. Life is lumpy. So the last year, my expenses have been nowhere near 50% on these properties. So my return looks incredible. But I know I can't rely on that long term because eventually there's going to come a point where I do need to replace that HVAC. And in that particular calendar year, my return is going to be abysmal. But when averaged out over the life of this, I would anticipate, and based on the expertise of people like Paula, that 50% is a rough number to consider. So that is kind of what I'm keeping in the back of my mind. But yeah, this first year has been an unrivaled success. But again, I know that's not going to last.
Now, I guess many investors just heard the $55,000 for a house and they had a little bit of a take back. I mean, I think the average or the median price for a home in America is closer to $130,000 as a guess. I haven't looked at any data, but I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I would expect that many people in their mind have a, you know, six-figure number attached to purchasing a home in many parts of the country. And the hearing that they're doing a step back, I promise you that in parts of Georgia, Alabama, and on the Eastern coast, there are many, many properties. I didn't find the only house that was selling for $55,000. There are many, many options at this price point. But that actually poses kind of an interesting question because, Brad, as someone that has reached financial independence, that has means, that has savings, and treats that savings like it's fungible, that money could be in your investment accounts or it could be invested in real estate. I know you were in a position just to pay cash for these houses if you chose to. And that also affects the return because with homes, you can use leverage. If you can get a bank to lend you money, if you can borrow money from someone, that is a way to potentially amplify your returns. But if you pay cash for it, now you don't have to worry about a mortgage. You have more stability. There's, you know, there's a compelling case to be made either way, but it will, as a math calculation, it will reduce your actual return because you had to invest more money to get this monthly rent check of $700 to $800 a month. I'm curious, did that weigh in and how did you approach it?
Yeah. So you're really going for it here, Jonathan. I like it.
That's why they show up, Brad. That's why they show up. They're counting on me to represent the questions they're having right now.
No, it's great.
Doing my part.
So yeah, I mean, in this case, and this comes back to everybody needs to treat their financial life with how they can best handle it psychologically, right? I think there's always the math answer with everything we talk about here. And as we've discussed so many times, the psychological aspect is probably even more important for most people because that is what holds them up. So for me, I've discussed ad nauseum how real estate investing frightened me because I had a terrible, this was like my biggest financial mistake that I talked about way back when, one of the first 10 episodes, and it was real estate speculation and it wasn't investing. It wasn't treating it like a business, but that scared me for years. So the way that I was able to do this is I actually did pay cash for these units and including the repairs. So I have no mortgage on either of these rental properties. So there's no psychological baggage for me. And I think that was something that helped me sleep well at night because frankly, Jonathan, if they're vacant, it's not like there's something catastrophic that's going to happen to me, right? It just lowers my return. And okay, I'm willing to handle that. So yeah, we did pay cash for both of these. And it's interesting because this ties into, Paula had a really cool illustration here of return on a rental property. And she said, so if you're following that 1% rule of thumb, then it basically rents for 12% of its purchase price, right? So 1% per month times 12 is obviously 12. And if we're saying 50% of that is going to be expense roughly, so that reduces it in half to a 6%, and she said, unleveraged dividend. So unleveraged in the sense that there's no mortgage, and dividend is basically that net income from that property is coming back to you, right? That is cash in your pocket. So that's the 6% dividend. She then talked about a 3% inflation to the increase in the price gets you a roughly 9% return if you follow that 1% rule of thumb and the 50% rule of thumb. So that's kind of a cool idea of, again, which ties into her quote at the end, which was, does this make sense today? Don't look at prices in the future. Don't speculate. Just, does this make sense as a business proposition today? And she said, the zen of investing, right? Be here now. And I thought it was super cool.
That's it. That's it. And that's what I want to say to our audience as we kind of close out this episode is be here now. And if you hear an idea that's exciting, use it as a springboard. Research it further. But don't just let these ideas collect dust, put them in the attic. Like, let's do something with it. And let's know that today is the next day in the rest of our lives. We have the rest of our lives to get 1% better. And we can start building our wealth and building our income streams one income stream at a time. Don't feel compelled just because we talked about real estate today to go get started in real estate because you have to be doing everything. Like, it's not a competition. You do you. Like, if you follow the basics of financial independence and the tenets and everything that we talk about here, you are going to be in a phenomenal place. But if this interests you and you have bandwidth, don't let fear keep you on the sidelines. Like, it's a problem. It's solvable. You've got this. And I hope that this episode maybe just gave you that little spark, that little inspiration that even if you're like, you know, just like Brad, like, oh, I'm scared it could go wrong. Like, figure out how to mitigate that and then take that next step. So Brad, I just want to know, brother, I'm proud of you. You got back on that real estate bandwagon after a really bad experience and you are not only surviving, you're thriving, right?
I am. Thank you very much. No, it means a lot. So thank you. And, you know, B, like, we all have hangups. We really do. And, you know, like you said, you just have to find a way around them, find a way to make it work. And, you know, this is something I thought about for years, getting back in the real estate investing sphere. And I pulled the trigger. And yeah, I mean, so far, so good. So it's very, very cool. So yeah, I mean, again, in closing, just a huge thank you to Paula. And I can't wait to here again, you know, again in this longitudinal study, right, with Zach and Marilyn. We'll certainly touch base with them in a couple of months and see where they are. And that's what's so exciting about this FI Household series. I'm really, really jazzed up about it.
All right, guys, just make us a promise this week that you will get started on your path to financial independence. And we've tried to make it very easy for you. Just go to choosefi.com/start. The fire is spreading, my friends. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.